Well, let me get us started this afternoon. First of all, I want to thank you all for being here on a snowy afternoon. I'm Christopher Manfredi, and I'm Dean of the Faculty of Arts, and I've been asked by the principal to convene and chair this open forum on free expression and peaceful assembly on campus, consistent with recommendation one of the Jutra report on the events of November 10th. Just to go through a little bit of the process so that everyone knows what we're doing and what is available, the means that are available for people to bring their comments and questions both within the public events and outside of the public events, I'll just provide a brief outline. As you know, if you've read the terms of reference, which are posted online, I'm conducting this with the assistance of an advisory group of nine individuals, three chosen by the Board of Governors, three appointed by the Senate, and three appointed by me. The list of the advisory group members are available, again, online, and I recommend that you consult that. The role of the advisory group is to provide me with advice about such things as the timing of the public events, the format of the public events, the location of the public events, how we can bring the open forum to the widest possible audience that we can. And after the fact, they are here, as they can be, at the events to listen to you, to take notes, and to provide feedback to me after each of the events, to review written reports that I will prepare and present to the community as the process unfolds. The process is going to unfold relatively quickly. We are supposed to wrap everything up by June 8th, which is the last day of convocation. The four dates of the public events have been selected. There is today's, March 1st. There is an event on March 12th that will be held between 10:30 and 12 in the SSMU building, the University Center, in the combined Lev Buckman and Overflow rooms. There is an event on March 27th at Mac Campus, and a fourth event on April 4th. The time and location of that event is still to be determined, although we are looking at a location in Upper Campus, either around the law school, Stuart Biology, or the medical school. The purpose of the open forum, as Dean Jutra recommended, is to provide for university authorities to provide and participate in a forum open to all members of the university community to discuss the meaning and scope of the rights of free expression and peaceful assembly on campus. And as you know, that recommendation came out of his report on the events of November 10th. And in that context, Dean Jutra raised four large sets of issues that he thought needed to be discussed. And I will run through those, and they can perhaps provide a focus for this afternoon's comments and discussions, as well as the comments and discussions of future events. So I'll just run through his four sets of questions. Can peaceful assembly take place in any location on campus? Are there areas in which demonstrations or occupations should not be allowed to take place? In what circumstances, if any, should concerns of safety and security for the demonstrators and other members of the community be relevant? In what circumstances, if any, are considerations of privacy, confidentiality, and governance relevant? When, if ever, should the protection of valuable property be a concern? That's one set of questions. There's a second set of questions. Is the deliberate concealing of one's identity in a protest or demonstration consistent with the notion of peaceful assembly? Does the contemporary culture of pervasive recording of any and all public events inevitably entail that some demonstrators will cover their faces? Are there any time restrictions? A third set of questions. Are there any time restrictions to peaceful assembly? Should the university countenance as a peaceful assembly an occupation or sit-in that impedes its activities over an extended period? Remember, this was written before the more recent events in the James Building. And a fourth set of questions. Are there justifiable limits to the rights of free expression and peaceful assembly in the context of demonstration, protests, and occupations on campus. Those are four sets of questions that he raised. In addition to those, I think there's an important topic that we haven't had an opportunity to discuss as a community that is not directly related to the events and incidents that gave rise to the Jutra report, and that concerns the university's approach to controversial speakers on campus, which I think is also a critical question around free expression and peaceful assembly. We've had incidents on campus in the not-too-distant past, at least three that I can think of, where controversial speakers have come on campus and either been prevented from speaking by other members of the university community, or been able to speak only with great effort despite attempts to prevent them from speaking. And I think that's an important topic that we should use this forum as an opportunity to discuss, that's not necessarily related to the questions that that gave rise to Dean Jutra's recommendations. My role in this is really to listen, to convene, and to try to reflect as faithfully and as accurately as I can the nature of the comments that are brought forward by the university community. On the advice of the advisory group, I am inviting written submissions by individuals and groups, and I am making myself available with at least one member of the advisory group to meet with individuals and groups outside of the actual public events to provide the greatest possible opportunity for people to make their views known on these subjects. As well, we're live streaming. We have provisions in place for people to ask questions and send in comments from off-site, so we're trying to do as much as we can to provide opportunities. What this isn't, in my view, this isn't a commission of inquiry. It's not a truth and reconciliation commission. It's not a forum where people can hurl recriminations back and forth about what did or did not happen in particular instances. I think that all of us have a responsibility to ensure that the quality of the discussion is as high as possible, and that really depends on the participants themselves. Depends on their being here, and it depends on their making intelligent contributions respectfully on the various subjects. So those are the parameters that I think we need to follow in order to get the most out of this process. And I'm certainly looking forward to meeting members of the community on this issue over the next couple of months, and having an opportunity over the summer to reflect on what I've heard and to write it up and to present it to the principal in October, as well as the opportunity over the next several weeks to discuss the process before the university's governance bodies when those opportunities arise. So having said all that, I will stop talking now and open the floor to comments, questions on any of those issues that I've raised, out of the Jutra report, or other matters that you think are pertinent to the question of free expression and peaceful assembly on campus. And I'm going to try not to stand behind the podium and make it a little bit more informal. There are microphones which you do need to use because of the live streaming, and I'm just going to let this be as open and open forum as I can, and invite members to come to the microphone and just make their views known on this. So thank you. There's a microphone on this side and a microphone on the other side. Don't be shy.
Hi, I'm Manuel from the Daily. I was wondering if this open forum is going to address in any way disciplinary proceedings for, in terms of protests and demonstrations on campus.
Well, certainly one of the things that Dean Jutra mentioned was that there are some ambiguities within the in the relationship between the Charter of Student Rights and the Code of Student Conduct and Disciplinary Procedures around the question of disruption of university activities and disciplinary procedures. There is a process ongoing to review the Code of Student Conduct and disciplinary procedures. There may be things that come out of this discussion that will feed into that. But while we're on the subject, I do have the Associate Dean of Arts, Andre Kostopoulos, here, who is involved in these, and perhaps he can lay out, just in general terms, what the Code of Student Conduct and disciplinary procedures are, so that we have a common understanding of what those are, if that's, if you would find that to be useful.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Andre.
So I think that the tension that you were referring to, and that Dean Chitra also refers to, has to do with the provisions of the code that that define disruption versus the provisions of the code that guarantee the right to peaceful assembly and demonstration. And there, it's not clear in the code what peaceful means. So that, I think that's noted very well in both the Chitra report and in your opening comments. Now, in terms of the student discipline process, you know, I can say generally, maybe explain a little bit how that works, because that seems to be an area in which many people have questions. Now, the discipline process starts with an allegation. And allegations can come from any member of the university community who feel that there has been misconduct on the part of a student in that case. Those come to a disciplinary officer. I'm the disciplinary officer for the Faculty of Arts. Disciplinary officer will typically do some preliminary investigation and see whether there's any sort of substance, potentially, even to the allegation. If there is, there's a call to interview. Call to interview is an opportunity for the DO and the student to examine the allegation together and any evidence that might be related to the allegation, and to reach a disposition of the case, of the allegation. That's pretty much... In some cases, an allegation can go to the Committee on Student Discipline, and that can be either at the choice of the disciplinary officer or later at the choice of the student involved. So I'm happy to clarify any aspects of the code or the discipline process as people ask. I'm here. I'm available. So.
I mean, one of the issues that arises, I think, is the fact that. And I tried to point this out in my message to the community that went out earlier this week, that the right to free expression and the right to peaceful assembly are both, in a sense, qualified rights. I mean, it's not a right to assembly, point final. It's a right to peaceful assembly. So one of the questions, of course, is at what point does an assembly cease to be peaceful? That's an important question, and I'd like to hear, I think Dean Jutra raised that as a specific question. What do we mean by peaceful assembly versus just assembly generally? And then, of course, there's no jurisdiction that I'm aware of that has a right to expression that is completely unlimited, that's completely unqualified. So the question is, what are the legitimate qualifications to those rights? And that's something that Dean Jutra seemed to indicate in his report. These are issues about which we haven't had a chance as a McGill community to talk about together, and that's one of the purposes of this. That's one of the things I'd like to hear from people is, what do you think we mean when we say free expression or peaceful assembly? What do those things mean, and what are the limits to them, if any? Absolutely.
Yeah, I guess I sort of have a follow-up to that then.
Sure.
From what I know, the Code of Student Conduct is being revised. I understand the provisional protocol that was issued a few weeks ago is also under revision. And then there's now this open forum on free expression. Are those three separate review processes, and are those intersecting or, like, communicating in any way with each other?
Well, certainly the I expect that the report that will come out of the open forum will feed into any discussion of the provisional protocols. They're called provisional protocols for a reason. And then also to the process that's ongoing on the Code of Student Conduct. So I think this is just another opportunity to hear people's views on these in a different forum. So it would be good to hear what those views are, actually.
I'm not going to express my views at this point, but I just want to clarify that the revisions of the Code of Student Conduct the process is a process that began last year and was unrelated to these events. And it was a process that was motivated by an understanding that there were some ambiguities in the code and that the code could be restructured, not necessarily changed, but restructured in its presentation to make it clearer to students and to other members of the university community. In doing that, there were a number of issues that had been raised over the years, and there's discussion about those issues to make some substantive changes, but the revision is not in response to the events of last semester or the events of this semester.
If I may just note briefly the three processes that you refer to, the three revision processes, don't affect the fact that at the moment our constitutional document, if you will, in terms of student rights and responsibilities, in terms of student conduct is the Green Book, basically, which is no longer green because it's online. But we can call it the PDF book now.
It's more green than ever.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. You can call it the PDF book or something. That's in terms of the discipline process anyway, that is the document. And I think as Deputy Provost Mendelson notes, like any constitution, it's a living document, and people are constantly thinking about how to rework it, about how to clarify it. As a DO, I know that we have several times a year meetings of the DOs in the university where everybody notes problems that they've encountered in the application of the code or questions they have. So it's not a completely straightforward thing, and it's constantly in need of evolution, and that evolution is ongoing.
Well, I mean, let me pick up on some of the questions that Dean Jutra raised, and I'll just pose them explicitly. And, you know, there are students in the audience. I can see you, and I want to hear what you have to say about these things. So the first question he raises is, can peaceful assembly take place on any location on campus? Is it a right to peacefully assemble anywhere? Or are there places that, by definition, where a peaceful assembly can't occur? I mean, that's a question he raises. Do you have any ambiguities about that? I'm gonna focus on you, sir, because you were here even before anybody else got here. So.
I guess all I can say is the obvious that, you know, anything, any place where, courses would be hindered or the movement of people, would be blocked or anything that gets in the way of, the university would be off, like, limits, so anywhere, like, outside in a open space, obviously not anywhere, like, you can just walk into a classroom and protest and disrupt things. That would be basically, like, obviously, not acceptable.
Okay. Other views on that?
I'm really here to listen, but I just came back from a conference in the States where I asked a couple of universities what their view on peaceful assembly was. And what I heard was that some universities have actually defined a very neutral space for peaceful assembly. So we're not the first to have dealt with this issue. I'm sure we won't be the last. But it was very interesting to hear that definitely they had no concept of having, they actually designated a corridor, it might have been a street, as a place for peaceful assembly that was far away from administrative buildings, academic buildings, but that was a consistent place for people to gather. So I just wanted to share that.
Well, I should, that's great to know that, because one of the things we're doing as part of the open forum is we're doing research on practices, policies, and regulations in other universities, both in the city, in Canada, and outside of Canada, to try to get a comparison of what kinds of practices there are out there, and so that's very useful. So that's really that would be an interesting question. Would it be the case that people think that one response might be to actually designate a particular area as the place where these kinds of events take place?
Again, also here to mostly listen. I'm part of the advisory committee, but I think that it's an interesting concept to have, like, a defined space. At the same time, though, it's always the thought of, like, out of sight, out of mind. And I think that goes against, like, they're protesting for a reason, right? Or there is an action for a reason, and part of the action inherently is to disrupt something, right? Otherwise, what's the point, right? Like, I think a lot of the times you can do, you can stand by, or you can make a point, you can have a large assembly, but part of the point is that direct action inherently disrupts something, right? So if you have a designated corridor that's far away from classrooms, administration buildings, and therefore doesn't disrupt anything, what's the point then? Why would they, they're never going to use it, right? It's like, oh, hey, we have, for McGill, you can go down to the old port and walk up and down McGill Street, right? But why would they do that then? And I think that's kind of, like, how do you address the need to make a point, the need to disrupt, and where can that be, right? And I agree, I don't think it should be in classrooms, I don't think it should be in people's offices, but that's, again, the point. So it's interesting, like, what it's a conundrum. So.
Thank you. Other views on that particular issue? Okay. Let me pick up on another one. Let me pick up on this one about, this became quite controversial on November 10th. It was perhaps less so in the more recent events. But the concealing of identities, are there any views on that? The practice of people concealing their identities as they engage in this kind of action. Sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Dave. I think the students on this campus know what they're standing for. People know what they want to represent, and people at large in the society. So if anyone wants to conceal their face, they're very unsure of what it is they're standing for. And I think when people occupy spaces like the James Admin, if they're really trying to get in the way of things, then they shouldn't feel hindered in any way. They should reveal themselves. People want to know who you are. If you're brave enough to stand up for something, then you should be brave enough to accept the consequences that are going to follow. And so, from what I've seen on the part of some of the students who've taken approaches like that, it's trying to take bold and brave steps, and they're very cowardly inside. And I also see, the impression I have of my administration now is people who are sitting ducks. Like yesterday, how can you allow students to come into a library, which is a shared space that their students use, where employees are working, and you're going to disrupt your fellow students just like that? And then to see security stand around, employees come out to watch them, and we just all watch like sitting ducks. It's disrespectful, and this is a campus where when you move into residences or everywhere, you're putting up these signs about safer space is like, what is this safe space? There's no respect on this campus anymore. And I find it in how the administration communicates certain things, how students communicate certain things to other people in the community, because there are very disrespectful students here. And I say that from a Jamaican perspective, where we don't necessarily speak to adults like that. For example, when they occupy the building, you don't go on a website and refer to your VP admin as a steak and wine-filled body. You're the same people asking for respect and recognition of the things you do, and you're disrespecting the people who you want to hear you. And to really create peace on this campus, like I even find forums like this to be pointless now. The university, in my opinion, has spent since September last year, or probably before that, doing consultations. What are these consultations for? And I'm certain with previous SMU executives or previous members of admin, the issues being addressed and raised today are issues that existed long before. So obviously, there's an inaction on everybody's part. This is now another forum for another problem that was in the community. There's a consultation working group to talk about consultation. Post that, we have consultations about every other issue in the university. What are we achieving in the university, and when are they going to be achieved? You have people come in, develop tensions, and they leave with the tensions. And people are just working on the tensions. And I can't understand how you know that tension exists in this university and we're not really doing anything to solve it. This is just another talk shop.
Okay, so let me challenge you to tell me what would be a more effective way of doing it. If this is just a talk shop, tell me what else should the university be doing?
I believe, and I'll say this, I had sent an email to 5 members of admin about what I think needs to be taken on their part. The only one of the impressive things I've seen or elected student representatives do this year before the last consultation thing that was held, when they dress up as suggestion boxes, it's an active engagement of our community. And I think that's the first time I've ever seen student representatives try to get something from the student body, even though I didn't see them. Gladly enough, they were captured in pictures to be put on the McGill website. So I sent an email to the administration saying, there are students post this occupation business who've called themselves the silent majority, who feel underrepresented because there's a louder minority. And so a forum like this doesn't reach out to the silent majority. They're never going to come. At the consultation events, the silent majority, the supposed silent majority, is never there. If you ask administration and student representatives to step out of the room, how many of the infrequent students are you going to see? So I said in that email, members of admin, I really can't believe it's going to be so hard for you to take a day or an hour out of your schedule, stop at a popular place on campus like a cafeteria. The engineering cafe is close to the James Admin building. There's no one in Trottier. Is it hard for you to go there, see a group of students and say, what's wrong? What can I do? How can I serve you better? Okay. So there needs to be that active engagement on your part as well as student representatives, because both sides have been failing and you guys are making this campus miserable and tense. It's not what I was looking forward to.
Okay, thank you. Any reactions to that? All right. Are there any other questions about, or go ahead.
Yeah, to bring it back to the concealing identity thing, I think if you have a designated place to protest peacefully, then there is no reason why someone should conceal their identity. That just demonstrates they're going to do something wrong. But also, I have to kind of understand, you know, that like people, like when they protest, like off campus, they're used to having their picture taken by you know, people who might work for the police or who else, so I understand the mentality of wanting to conceal your identity, but if there is a place, like, you know, on campus, like on Lower Field, where you can protest peacefully, then I don't see why people should hide their faces there.
Thank you. Sir.
Hi, my name is Pascal. Just to go back to Dave's point, I think, yes, there is a large sort of silent majority, but I think over the past year we've seen sort of outpourings against the minority, that the very, very vocal one. You know, we had the one rally on the relabeled community square in front of the James Edmund building. And during the James Edmund occupation, you know, the Facebook group that was started by someone attracted thousands of students. So I think designating a space on campus for those students to sort of voice their views would be a good point. You know, I agree with what you said, that the minority, that's part of their demonstration tactics to sort of disrupt university events. I was in the room when one small group disrupted the public service fair in the SMU building itself, very violently, actually. So I think while you can't prevent that from happening again, designating a space, telling students that's your space, you can go there, you know, voice your views, you know, maybe provide a wall to hang some leaflets or whatnot, would be a nice way to go about it and show students that it's their campus.
Thank you. Anyone else on that particular point?
Not particularly on that. Hi, my name is Alex. Just in terms of concealing identity, I want to rewind a bit to last semester and all the tensions that were going on with the Minaka strike and all this, and there was a couple of incidents, moments, for example, during one of the senates when they were discussing Minaka, and students were standing outside, and we had the whole situation with students being filmed on video cameras without their approval. And I would probably try to just point out that this may be one of the causes for the occupiers trying to conceal their identity. There needs to be probably more clarity on when students are able to be, whether they have a right to be videotaped or not in such a way. And on the other side, I would also argue that probably the occupiers have a right, some of them representing students as part of council and other student body, political bodies, and in such they're failing the trust of their constituents in such a way. So it's double issue, you know. But definitely, the administration should put more work on defining public rights on, you know, being recorded.
Thank you. Yeah. Are there comments on that? Yeah. Go ahead.
I don't find the videotaping comment, we're constantly being videotaped. There are video cameras almost everywhere. There are video cameras all over James Edmund. If you live in Newark, there are video cameras almost everywhere. When you're protesting and you get media attention, you're being video cameraed. And what's the big fear of being caught on camera if you're not doing something wrong? And I'll just leave it at that. But another thing I wanted to get back to is this. This is an indirect way of how I think admin communicates to students. And I understand why the action was taken, but I'm going to play it out for you. So post the occupation, I have seen, this is what I've taken note of. Getting into James Admin, it's like when a Jamaican is trying to go inside the U.S. Embassy. I'm seeing two guards protect the front doors of James Admin, a process was described to me that you now have to swipe your card to prove if you really work in there. Once you are within the hall, there's a security receptionist dude who will verify your purpose there. If there's a meeting, then you should have, then you would be logged in some document. If you're not registered, then they'll call and verify, and then you're given access to go further. So if that's the kind of action you're going to take with the James Admin building, will you do something similar for the McLennan Library when you have students actively engaged in preparing for work to protect, you know, every kind of space in a similar manner? And what I'm trying to say is this, that can't be the kind of bold reaction and response you're going to take, and it's just left like that. People just see this abrupt change. It's like, you know what, we know what you guys are up to. We're definitely going to keep you out now. It doesn't reflect well.
Thank you. Let me turn to a couple more of Dean Jutra's questions. I want to go to the point that doesn't really come out of his, changing the channel a little bit, and this question of controversial speakers. So in the last little while on campus, one can think of at least three incidents where speakers have been either completely prevented from speaking or could only speak after tremendous effort. So there was an incident where a pro-life speaker was prevented from speaking. There was an incident when the Minister of Immigration was prevented from, or almost prevented from speaking. There was an incident recently where a speaker in a mining engineering class or something like that was prevented from speaking. And there are other kinds of things like that where controversial speakers come on campus all the time that say things that some individuals or groups of individuals in the community find quite offensive. So the question that I think this forum can help us address a little bit, which we haven't really talked about very much in my 25 years at McGill, is what are the limits on that? What responsibilities does the university have, if any, to protecting the rights of controversial speakers to deliver their message on campus, if any? I think that's an important issue that we haven't really touched on. So if anyone has any views on that, I'd be interested in hearing them, and I think other members of the administration would be interested in hearing them as well. Or perhaps you don't think this is a problem.
So on the topic of controversial speakers, I'll give an anecdote of myself right now. I have been talking with a friend recently, and I said I like puppy dogs, and I was surprised when he said I hate dogs. So I think that having an opinion means that you're controversial to somebody on any subject, and that what we should be working on is that we can respond appropriately to whoever's opinion on anything across the board, be able to listen, respond, talk back and forth instead of talking past. I was actually really impressed when I walked into the room today about the people who were here. A little disappointed in the number of people, but to walk in and see Provost Massey, Provost Mendelson, and that group of people here to talk, I had no idea that they would be here. I thought that it's important that they're here and they're listening, and that people could have come and had conversations face-to-face, one-on-one with these type of administrators. But I've watched the YouTube videos of the amount of back and forth that happens, the shouting outside of James administration, the surrounding crowds around individuals like the senior administration. And I believe that being able to say whatever you'd like is important. Being able to say what your opinion is important. But you also need to know that the person listening may not like what you're saying, and that they should have an opportunity to speak back. So talking about all of this controversy, what you can say if you're a controversial speaker, if you have an opinion, you're controversial to somebody. And so we need to just work on that ability to talk back and forth. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, so let me get more specific. If someone tries to prevent a controversial speaker from doing, if their response is, to silence, try to silence that person. What should happen? Is there anything that should the university take action? Should the university defend the right of that person to speak, or should it stand aside? This has become quite a large issue on many campuses around the country. And I'd be interested, as a dean of a faculty that probably has a lot of controversial speakers both within it and coming to speak to it, I'd be interested in knowing what people's views are on that.
Hi, I'm Maggie Knight, mostly just here to listen. I don't think you'll ever get agreement on this. I think the reason that people try to disrupt controversial speakers to shut them down is either because they fundamentally disagree with them so much that they just don't think that opinion should ever exist, or because they feel as though the opinion or discussion being expressed fundamentally makes the university substantially worse place or make it an unsafe space. So if people are coming, some people feel very strongly that if somebody is coming and is denying the Holocaust, denying the Rwanda genocide, that kind of thing, they feel like this should not happen on a university campus. Like, it is an established fact that the Holocaust occurred, and we shouldn't be having people coming here saying that didn't happen. So there's some examples like that where I don't think you're ever going to get agreement. Because you'll have, for sure, some people who will stick very strongly to it's still freedom of speech. People should still be allowed to say that, even though a lot of people find that a morally abhorrent thing to say. But you'll have other people that say, no, if we are a society that cares about people and that cares about victims of the Holocaust and their descendants and our community, that the university should not allow that to happen. So I don't think you'll ever get agreement on that. But it's important to recognize that there is deeply held passion and concern that I think motivates some of those actions and towards shutting them down, and that they're not necessarily inherently like radical political action just for the sake of messing things up. They're principled stances out of a deep concern.
Hi, I'm Ken Hastings. I'm a professor here at McGill, and I think the university as a community, community where we invite people to hear them. So getting to your question, does the university have an obligation to permit controversial speakers to speak? I think if they're invited by our community, they're invited in. And so, yes, the university should do whatever is reasonable to make sure that that voice is heard. Otherwise, we're shutting out, you know, we're working against our own, you know, components that way. So that's my own opinion about that particular point.
That sort of begs the question, I think, that Maggie Knight was getting at. Are there speakers that we shouldn't invite?
But can I follow back on that? We as the community, are there speakers we shouldn't invite? I don't think so. I mean, I never thought of that question. But my own reaction would be to say, no, it's a university. It's a place for ideas. So there shouldn't be anything you shouldn't be able to invite. But I assume your motives are valid. So you should be able to invite anyone.
Thanks. Kathy.
Hi, sorry I'm late, so I'm just joining the conversation now. This wasn't quite the topic I wanted to come and listen about, but since I just lectured on John Stuart Mill in my modern political thought class, I thought I would just, you know, bring up some of his basic arguments about freedom of expression, which are that it helps us to arrive at the truth, that a truth is better defended when it can be actually exposed to, you know, challenges and so on. I think having said all that, though, I was involved in a recent incident where an organization at the university was going to put on a round table of some kind, which in my mind clearly involved two very polarized views on a debate, which I thought required nuanced, constructive engagement rather than sort of people with ideologically opposed views who clearly weren't going to convince each other. So I do think that there are certain kinds of speakers who basically aren't going to be the ones who would foster the kind of debate that you would want on very complex issues, such as, say, you know, anything that's controversial of a political or moral nature, right? And so I do think that there has to be some judgment used in dealing with those kinds of issues. The one that I was involved in had to do with things like you know, university racism or gender equity or issues of that kind. I think it was the equity report that came out. So the question is, why have a roundtable where you have speakers who clearly just have opposing ideological views, but who aren't going to actually, you know, get to the nuances of the argument and the realities of the situation? So I guess in some ways, I think some speakers aren't actually going to foster the search for truth or debate. And in those cases, I don't think that it's obvious that they should be invited. I mean, there's a politics to a lot of university life too, and maybe if you have sub-organizations inviting very polarizing speakers, the university could require that there be a kind of balance, you know, that there be a right of response or some other speaker who challenges the view. If you really want to maximize, I guess, freedom of expression, that might be one way to get around the problem.
So what did you really want to talk here about, Kathy? Now, you got the microphone. You have the mic now.
Okay.
So.
Well, sorry, I was late, so I don't know if you've already talked about this. But one thing that I realized the whole issue of November 10th and the struggle of how to deal with student demonstrators, you know, is a very difficult one for the university and for administrators. The one issue I wanted to bring up was what I've seen in some of the communications that has to do with the use of the word private in talking about office space. So, you know, I have an office at the university. I have a home that I consider private. I guess I don't understand what is being imported by the word private when we attach that to office space. Does that mean that I should think of my office as like my private home, in which case I clearly have exclusive rights to who comes in and who comes out? Now, if I really had that, there are many people, my students among them, whom I might not want to invite into my office. But in fact, I have to because I have office hours, you know, and no matter what, if they want to cry in my office, I have to let them. If they're angry and complain about the grade, I have to let them. So there's certain public functions of my office that I basically can't deny, right, whether I would like to or not. So I guess what I'm interested in, because I've also read things like the staff communications, the staff who were affected by the November 10th occupation, and what I'm a bit worried about is a kind of, we accept basically that their assessments of fear of students is valid. I'm not saying that they didn't feel afraid, but I guess one thing I would like to ask is why people are afraid of students. I mean, I worked with a police department when I was an undergrad as a 911 operator, and I can tell you people are very afraid when people, you know, invade your homes and with guns and knives and threaten to assault you or kill you. That's very true. But student demonstrators occupying an office are clearly not doing those things. They're not there to steal. They're not there to take your property. They're not there to assault you. And in many ways, I guess I find the excessive reliance on the language of fear and security in describing the reaction to student demonstrations, you know, very off the mark and problematic, because it conflates sort of, you know, the dangers of having an armed intruder with the problems of civic protest, which is that it's inconvenient and messy, and yeah, it's not what we'd like to happen in our offices, but, you know, this is a part of being a public institution, right? So this is something I wanted to ask. If staff could understand that, in fact, if they work in the principal's office, there is a public function to that office, and therefore they cannot treat that office as a private space, in principle, at least not all the things attached to that, then it may also affect, you know, their sense of, I think, indignation as well as fear.
I mean, there are others who can speak to that better than I can, but I think, one response probably would be that one doesn't know what the intentions of the people coming into one's office are. I would imagine that's one response to it, and that the cost of a false negative on the question of whether they're there to do harm or not is quite high. I suppose that would be one response. And I guess I'm here to listen too, not to pontificate. But you asked the question, so and we're friends, so I can answer it. There's also I've lost my train of thought now, so I'll let someone else speak.
Hi, my name is Carolyn Burrell. I actually work in the, hi, there you are. I work in the principal's office. Just, I don't mean to be niggly about points, but one issue that we did have for November 10th, and the reason there was fear, is that the people who came in never identified themselves as students and covered their faces, so we didn't actually know. And when some individuals in our office tried to ask, what do you want, why are you here, what can we do to help you, there was no answer, so we just didn't know. And I understand, I mean, we are an office that is in the service of the university, in the service of the principal, and students and faculty and other staff. So we're very open, and we welcome students generally since the events on November 10th and even since the events of February 7th, where it wasn't necessarily clear who we were dealing with and why and what we could do to help. It's become a little difficult, and in our office, I think we've sort of settled down and we're back to, I wouldn't say business as usual, as you know, has been noted that we do have increased security on the doors, etc. But certainly our purpose is clear to us. We want to be there and help students who come to us. And we've had students come with a variety of problems. I mean, you know, as you can imagine, we're a very central office. And as it pertains to space, it isn't a private space. And I understand the language is difficult, but I think that as an employee of the university, I should have an expectation that I can go into my office and get my work done because that's what I'm paid for. And there have been times during November 10th, during the February events where I haven't been able to do that. And, you know, on a personal note, I've fallen behind on things, and that's really annoying because it prevents me from doing my job, which is contributing to the life of the university, I would hope. So that I feel, as an employee, I'm not respected by the people that I'm working for. Sorry, I don't mean to stare at you. It's not all about you. It's just these are my general comments. I do have respect for my colleagues, whether faculty colleagues, students that I meet, that I have the opportunity to exchange with. And I would hope that they respect me as well, but these sorts of clashes really don't contribute to the collegiality and make it so that some of my colleagues, especially the ones in the most recent, who are affected by the most recent occupations, become justifiably a little fearful whenever they see a group coming towards them because you don't know what to expect now. Whereas before, you know, we have students in the building all the time, and, you know, meet people, oh, what are you looking for? Very helpful, collegial. We're working together in common cause. So it's been a little difficult since these events and since this, I'm not going to say it's a false adversarial relationship, but an unhelpful adversarial relationship has been developed. I'm not the administration. I'm Carolyn Burrell, work in the principal's office, and I try to do my job to the best of my ability for an institution that I really love and respect. So,
thanks. Patrice, there's another gentleman who was sort of in line behind you, Kathy, and maybe I'll let... Sir, you were... You were in line for a moment there.
All right.
Sure.
Thank you very much. I really appreciated that, and I think this is the kind of, you know, frank and helpful exchange that I wish people could have, you know, including those students who occupied, for example, the office as a kind of debriefing later after the events. So I guess one first thing I wanted to say is that I understand that it disrupts university activities, and I guess that is the point of these kinds of demonstrations. And so that part of it, I wonder if we would have a different view if we completely identified with the cause of the student protest, which I have to personally admit I don't. So I don't actually substantively endorse the reasons behind the protest. But imagine if I did, for example, if it was something about divestment of our funds from apartheid, you know, during the era of South Africa, right, where we might all say incontrovertibly the university shouldn't have been involved in investments and therefore there was some student demonstration. I mean, I think we would say, well, you know, one aspect of getting social change would be to have student demonstrations that disrupted university activity so that there could be some attention, you know, focused on this kind of problem, right? So I guess in the end, whether or not we agree with the substantive cause, we have to admit there will be these kinds of costs. And it may be good for people who work in that office to realize that that's just a part of the cost. It's not a problem for them personally, right? And it's also not really enough of a defense to say, well, we couldn't get the work done, and that's why there's something wrong with the fact that there's a demonstration. It's really, I don't think, a kind of personal thing, right? And I think that there are sort of purposes to disrupting the university's activities, obviously to make whatever political point is, whether or not we agree with it. There was something else I wanted to say, but sorry. But I really think that it's great to have this kind of conversation, and I wish that I wasn't the one having it. But I also, oh yes, the other thing I wanted to say is, yes, I do think that the student demonstrators on November 10th, you know, made mistakes in the way that they demonstrated. I do think that, you know, wearing handkerchiefs over some of their faces, you know, again, I guess, from what I've read, some of them did that in response to measures that they had seen being used in terms of videotaping people and fear of, being regulated and brought up under charges and so on. So it was partly a kind of interactive thing between administration policies, you know, and then the students trying to figure out how they could do it in a way that would protect themselves. And so again, I think a fuller accounting would also help, or perhaps better responses of the administration and its policies would also help to, I think, pacify the demonstrators in a way that wouldn't, lead to these problems where it's not obvious, what their identities are and so on.
Thanks. Other comments on this one? Mark?
I'd just like to say a couple of points. I'm a little concerned about the slippery slope that you're willing to go on, which is that the ends can justify any means. So it seems to me that there are some ends that we could all agree with, but that doesn't mean that we would all agree with any means to achieve those ends. So that we really have to, I think, be very careful. And I'd just like to support Carolyn's statement and say that people serve the university with dedication. They serve the university with the interests of students and faculty. They come to their jobs and they don't expect to be in an unsafe space. We hear from many different groups in the university that we need to create a safe space. The people who work in my office, I'm the deputy provost for those of you who don't know, the people who work in my office are members of this community, and they currently don't feel that they have a safe space to work in. And this is several weeks after the occupation. It is not legitimate to discount their feelings. It is not legitimate to discount their real reactions. Now, you might say, okay, the deputy provost has a somewhat public role in the university. Okay, so let's forget about him or her, if it were someone else. But I don't think that we should assume that people who work in the deputy provost's office should assume that they can have their space invaded, that they could have their space overtaken. And the privacy of their space is a privacy in the sense that I think most people in this room probably have pictures of their children or their parents or some personal pictures on their desks. I think most people in this room would feel that if you were at your desk, someone should not come into the room and immediately come around the desk into your private space. So we have a self-defined space that we consider our space, and it's not private in the same way that our bedrooms are private, but it's private in a very real sense. And there is a sense of having that privacy invaded, and I don't think we can discount that.
Josh, are we getting anyone sending anything? No? Okay, good. Go ahead, sir.
I'd like to speak from the perspective of somebody who's taught martial arts and self-defense to people for many years, and about how at the school that I trained at, it was mostly comprised of police officers, border control, and corrections officers. And I've had many philosophical discussions with them about what it means to be dealing with a large group multiple people and about the psychology of somebody who's confronted with that, whether or not there's an attack or whether or not there's a threat, about the psychology of how you respond physically and emotionally to that scenario. And in that context, I'd like to pose a question about a specific type of protest or collection of people, assembly, which would be a targeted assembly towards a certain person. Not a huge assembly where the idea is to get information out, to make a large amount of noise on the street, get everybody talking about your issue, but a targeted, say, occupation of the deputy provost's office, targeted very specifically on a specific issue for a specific person's office. And I would ask if 24 hours in advance they were to declare, we are planning on occupying your office for these things, looking for these items. If the university would take a look and say, we have stances on peaceful assembly, we have stances on freedom of expression, if the administration would say, all right, we're either going to say, we'll talk to you about these issues, we'll work through a different process, or we'll let you come and occupy. I don't have an opinion about what the answer should be. I'm actually really neutral on a lot of these issues because I've sat on both sides of the fence from my background. So I'm just thinking about different ways. If you make the assumption that the occupation would have happened on that Tuesday, it would have started on that Tuesday, what could have been done differently directly before it to make it feel different, to make it be different for the people involved, and to make it be different for the way that it affects the community? Different ways that you can look at that starting point. So that's the question I was hoping to pose. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think Adam has said that very, very well, as did Deputy Provost Mendelson. I think those are exactly the right point. I've been wondering, whatever happened to putting a document on the, nailing it on the door of some institutional spot to say this is what we'd like, because I have found, and I may be wrong, about the student protest situation, is that the university responds. Professors respond, administrators respond, at least I've always thought that that is the case. I didn't see the desperation in all of this to happen in the way that it did, and I think Carolyn's remarks were excellent. I think that's exactly right. I don't know what any of my colleagues would do if, let's say, our offices are a little smaller than the deputy provost, and I don't mess with Adam because he is a martial arts expert. So, but my point more is that what would any of us do if, say, three students came in or three people came in who maybe were on the younger side, one masked, two not, and were modestly aggressive? I mean, I don't think I'd ask them would they like an espresso. I really don't. I might, just to be a little flip, to get their attention. And then I would assess that they are a little mean-spirited, and I'd say, is it about my course? Is it about my personality? Is it about the university? Is it about the department? And if I didn't get an exact answer, I think I would want to dial 911 and get them the hell right out of there. It doesn't make the slightest bit of sense what they did on November 10th. I don't care. The occupation of an office is baloney in that kind of sense. If they want to do something, they could have been a gentler, more impressive way to express what they felt like. And I don't think any of our offices are open to that kind of procedure whatsoever. And I think that the slippery slope that you said, Professor Mendelson, is exactly right on. So,
thank you. Other comments on that? Do you want another retort? Well, maybe Maggie.
I mean, I'm a professor at this university, and I guess I really have to disagree with the deputy provost. Because I guess in the end, I think you use the language of privacy to assert something that I think isn't valid. I also think people's feelings, while legitimate, I don't think are a basis of sound reasoning. So often, for example, a slave owner could feel totally unhappy if their slave doesn't do anything, doesn't do the things that they want. But you wouldn't want to say that that feeling was legitimate in any reasoned way. You would want to say, well, the reason why the slave owner feels that way is because they feel entitled to use someone else as an object, and they don't like it when that object starts asserting some agency. So I think our feelings are what we call in political theory cognitive affective experiences. They also are windows to our moral
moral beliefs, our norms, and the values that we have, the way that we respect other people in the university community, including students who may disagree with our policies. So I think, you know, in that sense, while I want to say people have a right to their feelings, I also think that we need to think about why we have the kinds of feelings, emotional responses to things like student demonstrations. I don't think that the problem here at McGill is unique to McGill. I was going to write an op-ed about this, and I still may, which would be called something like The Winter of McGill and Democracy's Discontent, because it seems to me a kind of thing that has happened in our own society. When you think about how governments are able to channel protests by citizens and demonstrators into spaces where basically they have no political effect, right? So when you see some big political meeting of leaders, what political leaders don't want is to be held accountable to these large groups of citizens who protest against their policies. So the easiest thing for the state to do is say, well, you can't protest in front of them and actually cause a problem for them in terms of inconveniencing them. You know, you have to protest in these other places. And as a democracy, we've allowed that to happen. You know, when I was a teenager in the 1980s in Vancouver, we could have peace demonstrations that went all throughout Vancouver. Streets were stopped for us, and there was no sense in which we couldn't just, you know, basically demonstrate wherever we wanted. It was peaceful. Like, families went on these peace marches, you know, against cruise missile testing and so on. So I think that's the kind of democracy that I miss, and that's the kind of democracy that, as an immigrant, I grew up in Canada and felt like this is a free country, you know, that I can actually participate in a political demonstration on the Burrard Street Bridge and not have any policemen stop me and ask me, why are you here? You know, aren't you supposed to be in university? I mean, that's the kind of, you know, authoritarian state that my parents came from and fled from. So I guess it, for me, you know, the slippery slope is actually sort of in the opposite direction. When we start using the language of privacy and rights to basically say those in authority, positions of authority and power, really don't have to listen to people who are lower than us, who are inferior to us, who don't really have much power in decision making, and that we also can't accept sort of any kinds of critical protests that are outside of sort of the formalized channels of communication. I think that it's a big mistake for a democracy, and it's a big mistake for a university.
Thanks.
Thanks, Maggie Knight again. And for those of you who don't know me, I'm the president of SMU, the Undergrad Student Union on the downtown campus. I think one of the issues is that many students feel that there are opinions that they have which are valid, but which they don't trust will be effectively acted on by the administration, regardless of whether or not they're voiced by the student representatives. So I have people come to me all the time with various viewpoints that they recognize that I probably won't be able to contribute in a way that will actually be listened to, or that people come to me and tell me that they don't have any faith in the structures that exist at McGill, where if I actually did go and champion something and say, look, my constituents brought this concern to me and I'm bringing this to you, that it would actually be respected and acted on. Now, whether that's true or not is a much longer discussion, and I try to have those discussions with people, but that is a very real feeling. I personally think that we need to have a lot more discussions about feelings and emotions and how people feel about issues on campus. So I think I've had some really good discussions with some of the staff that have been negatively impacted by this and sort of recognize their fear of me now sometimes when I come, when they don't recognize it's me. And then I go, hi, I'm Maggie, I'm the student president. And they go, oh, okay, you're supposed to be here, right? And yeah, I'm a governor of this university. I have to be at this meeting. So it's very important to recognize the truth of those feelings and the impact of those feelings, and that I don't think anybody wants anyone on this campus to feel unsafe. That's not very healthy. That being said, it's also important to recognize the validity of the feelings of students that feel as though a university is overly securitized, isn't willing to listen to them, doesn't actually engage constructively on the concerns that they raise, and that those feelings have validity too, and so what do we do with them? And in both cases, just saying that they're not valid isn't an effective strategy. So how do we as a community go, yeah, it's okay for you to feel like this. We might not agree with you. We might not think that it's a rational basis to your concern. We might not think that we should actually act on it or change it. But we acknowledge the validity of that, and we recognize that you're likely to act based on those feelings. I guess I'll stop there, but I think it's unlikely that without substantial changes to the way the university works, or at least the way the university communicates, that you'll see some students not feel very disaffected and be willing to voice that in a myriad of ways.
So one of the things I'm hearing there is the concern that free expression, however wide it is not effective. There's an effectiveness problem. Whether that's true or not is another question. So I guess that raises the question of how does one make free expression effective, whatever the limits are on it.
Hi, Henry from the Daily again. This is another question I was wondering. I read the mandate of the Open Forum online, and in speaking to occupiers and student demonstrators like all year, I know some of their concerns and even outside of that group of students' concerns involve representation in bodies like Senate and the Board of Governors. Is a major concern that they feel like they're not represented by those. So I was wondering if the Open Forum is addressing that in any way, because I don't believe the Jutra report did.
So I didn't quite catch what the last bit of what you said.
I understand the Open Forum is using the Jutra report recommendations as a key structure for its mandate, and it's a lot of the questions that you've been asking today. But it doesn't touch on things like student representation at Senate and the Board of Governors, which is a big, in my experience, a big reason why these occupations and these demonstrations have been happening. So I was wondering if the Open Forum was going to address those.
Well, to the extent that people raise those as issues and think that that's important for me to hear and listen, it will address it. But you're right, it's not explicitly part of the recommendation. One of the Jutra report was about an open forum on free expression and peaceful assembly, and to the extent that expression is channeled through particular structures, and if people want to raise the questions about those structures, they can raise those questions. But you're right, it's not explicitly about the governance structures of the university.
I'm Lindsay Bowen, the legal advisor of the university, and I guess I'd like to address a question to your colleague. I'm sorry, I did not get your name. In your last intervention, you used yourself the expression peaceful demonstration, and I'd like to understand what is your definition of peaceful demonstration, particularly in the context of a university, and if you could give me examples of what you would consider not to be peaceful in the context of a university.
Sorry, I think I was going to come back. So. Sorry, Chris, I didn't mean to. I guess to me, and this probably does explain the fact that I was trained as a 911 operator with the Vancouver City Police when I was an undergrad student. So I've worked with police officers, and I've had some training in the law and things like that. Things that are obviously not peaceful would be, for example, if people damage private property, right? So if, people start, breaking windows at the James Edvin building, that would not be peaceful to me. That would be mischief. That would constitute some kind of police intervention because clearly you're damaging property or stealing things like files or wrecking, things in an office, doing things of that kind would clearly not be peaceful. But the act of actually just occupying, so if, for example, a group of faculty were to go to Dean Manfredi's office and occupy his, I'll just use him because, we have friendly relations, and we basically just went in with nothing, okay, so we're just, dressed normally, and we just decide to all sit in his office and take it over, that, and we don't destroy anything, in my mind, that would constitute a peaceful demonstration, right? We're not threatening anybody. We're not harming anybody. Our intentions, we can just declare, even if we don't obviously know what we want. I guess to me, it's unfortunate that students don't seem to know what they want and perhaps can't articulate, and maybe it's even faddish for them to say they don't want to say what they want. So to me, that's not a very politically effective kind of strategy. But you know, the fact is, it's also quite obvious when you know, if you have people who are not masked and, you know, entering an office and they say, well, our purpose is to occupy this for the purpose of whatever, you know, whatever problem we have with Dean Manpreti. It seems to me that as long as they're not damaging property or threatening people with physical violence, then that's, you know, that constitutes a peaceful demonstration and therefore a subject of negotiation, you know, and obviously the university can do certain things to try to give them incentives to leave, and all of that is within the bounds of negotiating with a peaceful demonstration.
So, Kathy, since you're in my office, so let's say after about an hour of hearing your complaints, I said, look, I've got to go now. I'd like you to leave my office, and you refused.
Right.
Does it?
Well, you know, I mean, you can leave your office. I mean, I probably want to leave as well, but, okay, assuming I'm a committed demonstrator, again, as I say, it's a matter of waiting, right? It's, I guess, to me, a university as a place that maximizes tolerance and maximizes democratic practice, we have to be able to live with things that are not, you know, things that we normally would desire. And I also think we have to, in perspective, realize that these are not things that often go on regularly. These are very, you know, rare occurrences. They're not things that should be routinized. So I assume that these things don't happen all the time. They're not routinized. They're not provoked so that they are routinized. And I guess in that sense, then, yeah, maybe it's going to last a few days, you know, which I guess one of the recent ones did. But in the end, you know, as long as they're not damaging things, as long as they're not threatening people, you know, to me, that is not fundamentally an unsafe problem. It's a very inconvenient problem, but it's a very inconvenient and not unsafe problem in the sense that no one's life is being threatened, nobody is being threatened with anything that under the criminal law would be considered, you know, an act of physical assault or, you know, any of the main things that we think generally police officers are for.
Would you allow me, Chris, to ask for another clarification? Do you think there's anything to make of a particular situation where there's a great number of occupiers who may be quite boisterous, very vocal, perhaps shouting, yelling, not allowing the people whose office is occupied to talk or to discuss with them, to some degree of verbal violence? Would that go beyond a peaceful assembly?
I mean, the verbal issue is difficult. I guess the question is, what would be the options for the people whose office it is? Let's say they can't do the work because of the boisterousness of the group. I mean, I guess they can leave, right? That's one thing they can do if they can no longer do their work. That partly is part of the political protest purpose, you might say, is to disrupt the activity. So, all right, so let's say that they end up realizing they're not going to be able to work. Then they might leave. So does that, again, constitute something where I would think that some kind of, you know, because the question, I think the upshot of your question is, at what point should the university try to employ the use of force in order to remove people, right, from an office? And so we can argue whether or not it's a good thing to do. I would argue maybe for student demonstrators it's not a good thing to do, to, you know, keep yelling your head off and disrupt things in that way. But that's a very different question of whether or not that would justify anything like calling in the police or using security guards, which you can't do anyway, to apply force in order to remove them. Right?
I guess my point is very different. It's not at what point should the university decide that it's no longer peaceful, but rather at what point should demonstrators realize that what they are doing is no longer peaceful.
Dean Manpreti, sorry to stop. I think when you speak about having a round table,
yep,
this is where we're going. We're like different sides. I'm not going to talk.
Well, we're certainly, well, it's a dialogue. They've got people with different views. Someone's asking for a clarification of a question. We're almost at the end of our time. We have one more person who wants to speak, but the question was about the onus on individuals to understand that they may have crossed a line, and do they have a responsibility to walk back to the other side of the line?
Yeah, well, like I say, I would certainly want to give demonstrators advice such as don't do things like yell off the top of your head. And you know, I do think that there are sort of ethics of peaceful demonstration, too. And perhaps students should actually, you know, come to have a discussion about that. Maybe the university can foster that. But, you know, again, in terms of the legal, in terms of, I think, the question of the response and especially the question of forcible removal, I think that that has very strict and clear standards. And it seems to me that all sorts of things would be tolerable, even if they do things that, yeah, in the end, we don't think are very politically astute or very ethical in terms of peaceful demonstration, right? So, but again, I think there's nothing about yelling off the top of your head that makes your demonstration any less peaceful from the point of view of the question of when should a forceful intervention be justified.
One last point here.
Hi, my name is Courtney. Oh, this is loud. I have a few notes. Before, you were talking about how can we increase communication and dialogue on this campus, and something that has come up in past forums that I've been to, or at least the last one that I've gone to in past conversations that I've had, is an open door policy or office hours. And I don't know if those exist right now, but if they do, I don't know of them, and like I have gone out and like looked for them online and asked people about them, so I'm just assuming that they don't exist. And I feel like forums and consultations like this can become really heated, and they have in the past, because people don't have a place to, like, or, like, other reasonable means to voice their opinions and their thoughts and their feelings. That's why, like, forums like this and consultations like this can become so heated and, like, full of emotions. Which leads me to my next point. People act in protest when they feel like they don't have access to power, or there is a lack of access to power, and the only way that they can have their voice heard and, like, seen is by disrupting things and, like, resorting to protests and confrontations. And, like, I think that the only way to possibly change things for them or the way that they see it is that they have to resort to these contentious tactics, and because otherwise their needs and thoughts will just be continued to be pushed to the side and ignored. Which brings me to my last point. Like, my heart is racing right now, and I think it's partially because of this mic, and I'm not used to speaking in front of a mic. But I also don't feel comfortable speaking here. The format of this consultation seems so flawed to me, for a number of reasons, which I'm going to quickly outline since we're a bit close on time. First, it's relatively formal, and as a student, like, I feel like I would rather have more casual conversations with those in power and those that are, like, making decisions for me. And, like, speaking on a mic or, like, having a stage present, like, I feel like this entire consultation has been very formal, and which is fine because, like, we do have other means, but I feel like those other types of consultation fairs should be highlighted more, and I think those seem to be well attended, which brings me to my next point of why I'm not comfortable speaking here. There are, like, less than 40 people in this room. And of those, the students are minority. And, like, that is not representative of what the McGill community is. So much of the McGill community is the students. And, like, I don't think that it's fair that so few students are here right now. And, like, I think that's something else that should be worked on. And I think if more means of communication are open and bridged, then there will be greater representation of students in the McGill community and the population. And the last reason why I'm not comfortable speaking here right now is I feel like by speaking and, like, just being here right now, I'm almost validating this type of consultation to students. And I don't feel comfortable validating it for the points that I just outlined above. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, we've reached the end of the time for today. All those are all, I take your points on the structure. I like more informal things, nature of the room. I want to thank everyone for being here this afternoon and remind you that we have another one on March 12th, 10:30 to 12 at the University Center, and I encourage you to let lots of people know about that and make sure they come to that one. So thank you very much.